Thank you for joining us for this episode of Journey Now, produced by Journey Church in Brentwood, Tennessee. For more information on Journey Church and our gatherings, visit journeytn.com.
Welcome to the Journey Now podcast. My name is Kevin. I'm sitting in for Mike in the host seat today. We invited others, but they weren't able to make it. But today, I am with two of my closest friends, Susie Lind and Alyssa McNally. And so, like usual and normal, we're going to take something from current events and have a conversation around it and how it relates to the church and how it relates to just how we kind of live our lives. This one's pretty invasive. This is a pretty invasive conversation. Just yesterday, President Biden ill-advisedly blamed Facebook for causing or killing people for the cause because of the way they were handling misinformation about COVID on
Facebook. Didn't they also say it was 12 people on Facebook? Something like that. Like, there are 12 people on Facebook that are the whole problem.
Something like that.
I wanted to know if I was friends with those 12 people.
So now,
You might be.
I probably am.
Yeah. Randy definitely is. Because he only has 12 friends on Facebook. but herein lies our question of the day is, as Biden tried to walk back his statement, he's saying basically that the social media platforms of the day are filled with and are passing on misinformation, and people are reading it and believing it.
And well, and sweet Marge got blocked today for 12 hours. She got put in Twitter jail.
Sweet Marge.
Sweet Marge from Georgia. No, that was super sarcastic.
Yes,
and
it was.
And snarky, all the things. Sorry.
Wow. Yeah, we're good.
We're good.
But that's part of the dilemma, I would say, because we, as a church, as Christians, we use social media. We're on it. We engage with it. We utilize it for passing along information. We also can be at times not be very discerning, just like other people. But ultimately what happens is that, and I know this is a problem because I've heard it countless times on the news, is that gossip has, or bullying or slander are all part of the equation. And people are not as discerning oftentimes on social media. They just pass stuff along because it sounds right. So how do we then engage? How do we engage? And what do we do with this? Because I think this is a dilemma. This is truly a cultural moment.
Yep. And I mean, to Biden's point. To his point. Instagram and Facebook have done a lot of work to try to correct misinformation. Mm-hmm. Instagram and Facebook, one and the same, owned by the same company.
Yeah, I mean, every time you mention anything about COVID or election or whatever, they have like a...
You know, and one of my favorite things, are these posts that people are putting around, like, if Instagram can do this, why can't they do other things? Like, why can't they stop child pornography? Why can't they stop all this? Which, fair point. Fair point. I like that point. But still, Instagram and Facebook are putting out an effort. I don't know why I'm defending them right now, but they are trying. They are trying to, you know, give access to right information and to call out when things aren't correct to the best of their algorithm's ability.
Well, they're trying to also differentiate between free speech and slander and gossip and misinformation, right? I mean...
Well, I think they would argue that gossip is free speech.
Yep.
I'm not sure they would say slander is, but I would definitely say that gossip is free speech.
What about misinformation? I mean, that's, it's really more misinformation that's the problem right now.
Out and out lying. Yeah, about things. I think that's the question.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, obviously, like, slander is something that is a part of free speech as well. I mean, Donald Trump was our president for a long time, and he used slander and misinformation pretty much every day. No one stopped him. So, sorry, just had to add that.
Yeah, I hear you.
I think Randy's going to edit that part out.
Well, but no, I mean, to be fair, though, what we're talking about, it's not, I mean, we started the conversation with President Biden. I mean,
yeah, right.
Like, we're not taking teams here.
No.
You know, like, President right. Biden said this thing. Yeah.
That was
Facebook,
pretty stupid.
And he's yeah. backtracking also. So,
yeah. Oh, yeah.
So we're not, I mean, that this is not what the conversation is about, right,
not
Kevin?
At all.
It's more about, like, how then yeah. do we live?
Yeah. How then do we engage mm-hmm. in something that has become so culturally
yeah.
invasive,
mm-hmm.
knowing that it's got a good side
yeah.
and a dark side.
Well, I would mm-hmm. say the very first thing is, it's like, you better believe we should be engaging. I would say that's the number one thing that I have to say. Yeah, engage.
Why?
Because he just said it's culturally invasive. And if the church stays silent and people of God and people who believe in goodness and love and grace don't participate, imagine how worse it would be. Like,
you're saying participate in social media?
Yes.
Okay.
And participate in the hard conversations. I just don't see Jesus backing away from hard conversations during his time on earth. I don't think that's a part of the playbook that we've been given.
Mm-hmm.
I think we're 100% supposed to be there, be in the thick of it, have the hard conversations. I also think, just like if you went to college or if you went to high school and you had to prepare a paper and you had to get sources for it, you had to get credible sources, right? You had to go back, read it, understand it before mm-hmm. you used it in your paper.
Which my children have been told by certain teachers that Wikipedia is not one of those.
Correct. That is correct. Good job. You want to know why? It's an open source platform. Anyone can add anything they want to Wikipedia.
I think somebody added to Wikipedia
no way.
This week to
is
Governor.
That true?
Yes.
Yeah, because somebody this week added to Governor Lee's page.
Oh no.
That he's serving his one and only term.
Really?
So that goes
on
to
Wikipedia.
Show you. Yeah.
And it's not over yet.
I don't know if it's still up, but
it's just like a race to whoever can change things
quick.
Yeah, it's hilarious.
Good to know.
Yeah, Wikipedia doesn't mean
yeah,
anything.
You can say whatever you want.
Yeah.
So Wikipedia is not a source. It is a conversation.
Neither is BuzzFeed. Like, anyways.
Or Reddit.
Yeah. Let's go through a list of things that maybe you should be weary of before you share them.
I know, it is kind of fun, but it's
Reddit's
not.
Social media, basically, guys.
Yeah.
Okay. It's opinion-based.
It's
opinion.
Rant-based.
Yes.
So is Medium. Medium is literally like lay people writing articles. Like, stop quoting it.
Okay.
What
is that?
Medium.
Okay.
Medium's not like, there's no journalist on Medium. It is like people like you and I writing opinion pieces.
It's blogs, basically.
Yeah. Anyone can have a Medium account.
Okay.
Which there's good stuff on there,
no,
but
no,
you have to.
I believe you. So
it's not like New York Times and NPR and a lot of other great ones that are more conservative.
Well,
that
Wall
are
Street
vetted
Journal,
a little bit more. Thank you, Wall Street Journal,
Newsweek, Time. They all
go ahead. Yahoo News.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yahoo News is great.
Actually, I'm a fan of Yahoo News. I admit it.
That's like the only thing good left on Yahoo. Their news.
Yeah,
is great.
But there are some people who would say a lot. Like, there's people who would say all of those things are fake news, and you can't trust them either, right? The whole mainstream media thing.
Right.
So how do you engage,
so you
Alyssa?
Have to vet. You have to vet things somewhere. You've got to do work. You just
yeah, you
can't
do,
be passive.
You have to do work. You have to read from multiple sources. On my best days, if I'm going to share something, I've read it from Fox News. I've read it from NPR. I've read it from New York Times and, you know, a couple other sources. And before kind of gathering my own opinion about it and gonna share and talk about it, I've done my homework. I've listened to all sides of the story.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're right. Like, everyone, every single person writes with an agenda. That is by nature of the human experience. Everybody has their own agenda. Everybody has their own bias. Some people are better at recognizing that bias than others, and some people are better about calling it out. But every single person does it. It's unavoidable. Mm-hmm. So that isn't bad. That isn't negative. We can't demonize that, because that is literally
human.
It's humanity. Like, mm-hmm. it will always happen. We can't demonize that. We have to celebrate that.
Mm-hmm.
There is room for multiple opinions,
mm-hmm.
and it doesn't need to be so polarizing. It's more so just recognizing what is opinion and what is fact. I was a journalism major in college, and literally they do beat out of you. Don't put your opinion. This isn't an opinion piece.
Right.
State the facts. You're like, mm-hmm. the only, like, my journalism professor stated this long before it was a popular issue. She said the only news outlet that still does traditional journalism, and it's still true, is the New York Times. If you read through their entire newspaper, which if you have that, amazing. If you don't, that's fine. The first sentence is a lead sentence. They always say the actual facts of what's going to happen in the rest of the article, unless if you're in like the commentary section. Yeah. If you're in the news section, it is like literal straight facts in the first sentence, which is how you write a proper news article. It's not opinionated. It's just, here's what happened. Here's exactly what we know. That's it. It's just like an exchange of information in a very coherent way. That's news sharing. And then there is commentary, there's opinionated, and that is where we get a lot of other, that's majority of other news outlets, right? And it's also what social media is. So we take the facts, you and I make our opinion about them, and then we write accordingly. There's nothing wrong with that.
Right.
Inherently.
It's inherently. I don't think there's anything wrong with that. It comes down to an individual's interpretation of something. So it's like, Susie, for example, I would offer that you, and you too, Dad, you just don't really post on social media, is like...
I'm not as engaged as the two of you.
Yep. Calling you out on that one. Yeah, but yeah, there is a level of responsibility that I think you have as someone who is a pastor and leads people, and it teaches people how to think about things. Like,
and
is,
I've gotten in trouble doing it.
That's okay.
I mean, I've done it poorly.
Better to get in trouble than to do nothing at all, in my opinion. Not to call you out, Dad. That was not my intention. That's what it sounded like. But I think, no, I wanted to honor the risk that you're taking, Susie, because I think it's a brave thing to do.
Yeah.
And it is, it's honorable. It wasn't an intent to be rude to you, Dad. But I think.
So it's interesting, though, because you and I have talked about that a lot. Mm-hmm. And I think it's hard to not get caught up in my own emotion about things. Based on...
Well, don't demonize the emotions, Easy. The emotion is beautiful.
I'm not demonizing. I'm just saying it's hard. Sometimes I respond on my emotions rather than the facts.
Right, but I think those are all okay, too. Like, and I think that's the tension, right? It's like everyone's going to have emotion about... I would be more concerned if you don't have an emotional response to injustice than just like a factual, like, this is wrong. Well, yeah, of course it's wrong. It should evoke emotion within us.
Right.
Jesus had emotion. Like, there's like... That's a beautiful thing. And like to lead people into that emotion with you and to share that narrative and to share that story is equally important.
Yeah. But what happens is, at least my understanding of social media is it creates an algorithm on your, what you like, what you read, what you, and it feeds that.
Yeah.
So you live in this, I would argue, what is called an echo chamber.
Yeah. It's operating exactly as it was designed to. It's honestly brilliant. So as a marketer, what we do is we create content for our target market. And we know that if we get the right, if we hit the content just right, our target market will like it. And then all of the same people that are exactly like them that will buy our product, that will like our brand, will get the same content because the algorithm knows that this person likes this. So keep feeding it to that kind of person. And then once they can recognize that that person is in a larger group, they'll feed all of that same group the same content. It's designed exactly to be that way because it's supposed to be a pleasurable experience for you and something that you want to keep going back to. It's designed that way, not supposed to be in a negative thing, but an actually quite a positive thing. And it makes my job what my job is. Like, I have to create content that will go to a specific target market.
Okay. That is
talk about
what
this
you just described.
Thanks for having me on today.
So good. but what you just described is
part of the issue.
Yeah. I think part of the issue is that then they don't hear a more balanced or opposition to what they're being fed. It's why it's why somebody who only watches CNN on a day only hears one side of a story. And
I think that's the part that's the whole, this is how we live is we have to really recognize what social media is and what its role is in our life, because we just heard from a marketer that we are a target.
Yes,
right?
Absolutely.
We are a target in order to sell a product. Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. So if you don't keep that in mind, then you'll just be used and you will get caught up in how you are being used. And so there has to be kind of a shift in like acknowledging that, but then also like, how do I use social media to work for me so that it is a pleasurable experience that I go back to, like you said, but I'm using it to...
It was designed to be addictive.
Yeah. I mean, just watch The Social Network. It shows, lays it all out there for you. Totally. All the cards are on the
table.
It's
not a mystery, but yet it's it's still very, it's so invasive.
I do have a counterpoint.
All right.
For kicks.
Let's go.
So there is more to this, I think. Okay, so I'm going to use Facebook as an example because it's easiest. So if you're on Facebook, I'm on Facebook. All of the things that are in your feed, 98% of it, is our friends' content, right?
Yeah.
So in reality, it's not like Facebook's feeding me that. They are pulling up the content that they think I'm going to respond to the most to the top of my feed. Uh-huh. So, but it's still just my friends' content.
Yeah.
So, like, I'm not getting, like, someone that I'm not friends with content, unless if like Susie commented on it and they think, and the algorithm thinks that I might also be interested in it, then it's going to pull it to the top of my feed. That's how that works. Oh, so
good to know.
So all of that being said, on Facebook, I don't have a lot of liberal friends on Facebook. I have the majority of conservative friends on Facebook. Now, I keep trying to tell Facebook by my interactions that I don't like that stuff, but I still get fed conservative content. Why, you may ask? Because all of my friends from growing up are my friends on Facebook, and the majority of my friends from college, right? Like, yeah. I don't, I have some Nashville and like my new life friends, but like, not really. Majority of them are like old Christian friends.
Because you've moved off of Facebook into a different.
Yeah, I actually still use Facebook every single day, though.
Oh, okay.
So I think that the other thing that we have to consider is
Alyssa is heated right now.
Oh, I know.
I mean,
this
if
is
you
great.
Guys could see her, she's just like moving around. I mean, she is like so much energy about
she's
this.
She's teaching
this,
us.
This is my cup of tea.
Sorry, I just need the people to like envision what you are.
I'm jazzed.
Embodying right now. So, good. So okay, go
so
ahead.
Good.
Because here's the thing, I still go back on Facebook because it's still addictive, right? But part of the issue isn't that, like, I'm friends with the people that I think like I do. Actually, I'm friends with all these people who think very differently than me, and I've been trying to get them to delete me as friends for months, years,
but
really.
You're just so lovable.
I would agree with this.
I mean, my aunts.
I've seen some of it.
My uncles, my you know, all sorts
all
of people.
They all still follow you.
What in the world are you talking about? You cannot possibly believe this. Like, I get these comments, and I'm
who
like.
Who is your father?
I'm like, maybe you should delete me. Like, I have been trying to provoke you to delete me since, like. The election, but anyways.
Yeah.
I voted for Hillary. You think that would have caused them to
unfollow? You put that on Facebook.
I did. Over and over again. And they still are my friends, okay? So
that says something about them.
Yeah. That's not the point, though. My point here is that it is actually just the, okay, so me as an individual, I create the reality on social media that I want. I surround myself with the people that I surround myself with. It is a choice. Mm-hmm. On Instagram, Instagram's a better environment for me because I don't follow any conservative people on Christian. If you post stuff I don't like, I unfollow you because that's like, I just don't really want that kind of energy in my life. But on Facebook, like, they're just my friends. Yeah. So if you're just friends with your friends on Facebook, of course you're just going to get people who think like you do. That's part of it. And so it comes down to, in my opinion, an intentionality of a person by person to say, there's more to the world than just what I think and what my friends think. And I should saturate my world and my thoughts and the way that I think about things with other viewpoints. Now, the majority of people don't like to do that because it's uncomfortable and it's hard and it takes time and it takes intentionality. Okay. So it's not just the algorithm's fault. It's also the individual's fault.
I agree with that. But in just to redirect this a little bit. That was awesome, Alyssa.
I heard she's trying to unsaturate her life. That's all I heard.
Okay, that was what you heard. I heard a lot in that, and it was well stated. Here's the question for those of us who, we hear this, I get stuff sent through. This isn't just on social media, but on Twitter, social media. But like, I'll see stuff on Twitter, and people are forwarding it and retweeting it, and they're also doing it on Facebook, and I just don't spend a lot of time there. Instagram, I just look at the pictures. So let's just be honest. So, but from my perspective is that I see stuff pass through, and I go, that's obviously not true, right?
Right.
I don't do anything.
I do.
Yeah.
Susie's like, I just, see that it's untrue.
In my mind, I go, who would believe that? You know, that's where I go. My mind goes to, why would anybody read that article? Mm-hmm. Or why would somebody? And yet, it gets traction. Mm-hmm. It gets, it gets likes. It gets all kinds of stuff.
People get fired up.
Yeah. What
they all start picking up their stones.
Do we have any obligation as we engage with social media to speak to that? That's, you know, because
to speak to the misinformation,
the gossip, like there's stuff that flies through and you kind of go, well, that's obviously not true. I've gone to a couple websites of people that have said outlandish things and I thought, whoa, you know, you get to the website and you kind of go, okay, this is crazy land.
Yeah.
This is conspiracy land. What are we to do, or how should we respond as Jesus followers, truth tellers, to obvious and blatant, just let's use the word misinformation. Yeah.
Susie looks like she's about to talk.
Well, I mean, no.
She just rolled her eyes like, whoa.
I mean, you're the expert in this. Yeah. So
is there, I mean, we've reported things to Facebook, like this is obviously not true, or.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's all a case by case basis. I think everything, for me at least, everything starts with relationship. Mm. So if I have a relationship with somebody, and they are somebody, it's the type of relationship where I have been invited to speak into them and vice versa, then yes, I'm going to say something. If it's somebody, you know, who, you know, is a part of our community here at Journey where it has something to do with that, then of course, you know, or if it's, you know, a friend who is deeply disturbed by something, I'm going to say, hey, you know, there's this other side of it. If it's someone I don't know or someone who they're just choosing to believe something without even thinking about it or whatever, and it's someone I don't know, there's that whole, like, the scripture that comes to mind is throwing your pearls before swine.
Yeah, so you know? Don't bother.
Don't. I mean, it's like there's no point at some point. It's really obvious when someone has made up their mind, and by engaging with it, you're just further provoking it.
Okay.
And you're adding oxygen.
You're exasperating.
You're adding oxygen. Well, you're being you will be exacerbated, but you're also adding oxygen to a fire that is like, you don't have the ability to put out because they're, it's just out of control already by the time they've gotten to this point, you know? And sadly, you know, we talked about, you know, facts and media and blah, blah, blah. I mean, this is the problem that people have right now is you can find sources to support just about anything. Now, whether those sources are credible or not, that's a whole nother thing. But it's like, you know, you can, that's what I hear from people all the time right now with everything from COVID to masks to, you know, everything is that like, oh, well, there's just so much information out there. I don't know who to believe and I don't know who to trust. And everyone says something else and, you know. Yeah.
And the government changes its mind.
Right.
That's
a whole nother issue.
Well, okay, well, we won't go down the path. but this is where we started.
Yeah.
Was the government was blaming, in essence, if you take Biden and say, Facebook is killing people because they're propagating misinformation. I hear Lissa saying, this is partly our fault. It's partly the participants' fault.
100%.
Because they add to it, or they're not discerning, or they don't take the time to really discover for themselves. What I hear you saying is people are so overwhelmed, Susie, by the amount of information that is out there, they either check out, or they don't want to do the work, or there's just, it's too conflicting.
Right.
And so we find ourselves in this weird spot. We find ourselves in this weird spot where something that is so powerful and so invasive into our world, into our culture of that we call social media, that from TikTok to, you know, people believe stuff that they see on TikTok and they try stuff that sometimes kills them. Is that TikTok's fault? Is, you know, try the, what is it? The detergent pod.
Tide Pods?
Tide Pods.
Yeah, yes. Don't eat the Tide Pods, kids.
It will not cure anything.
Oh, we're talking about two different controversies.
Oh, awesome.
You're talking about the COVID cure, right?
Yeah.
And I'm talking about a couple years ago when it went viral for kids to eat Tide Pods to get high.
I didn't know that.
That was
okay.
A thing.
Any way you look at it, okay? And either way, all right? Let's just pretend that a little bit of, eating detergent's a bad idea.
It's a bad idea.
Right. But yet,
like, even if you Google it,
yeah,
that will be what it
yeah, right. I but the influence of that alone is a scary but yet real threat.
Totally.
And I think but blaming TikTok is like it's like
blaming computers.
Right.
You want to blame the iPhone?
Yeah, it's the iPhone's fault.
If it wasn't for the iPhone, there wouldn't be any TikTok.
Yeah. Mm.
So maybe we should just blame Apple.
Well, there's people who do.
I mean, what
right.
do
you... It's just...
Well, I guess you could use it on like Samsung smartphones.
And before that, they blame cars. And before that, they blame, you know...
They're... We all need an enemy.
Right. And so social media has become that.
Right.
In some respects. And it's easier for Biden to say that it's Facebook's fault, or it's easier to say it's TikTok's fault, or than it is to actually go, okay, what do we need to do as human beings to engage now in a whole new thing that has flooded our world? That's the struggle. And I think as Christians, we have to ask legitimate questions of ourselves as we engage it. Are we perpetuating falsehoods? Are we, because we're people of truth.
Right.
That's the dilemma for me, is that's why I oftentimes don't engage, is because A, I don't have the time to go down the rabbit hole and go, how deep do I go? And so I just ignore it. And again, I'm hearing you. Okay. So there's a degree of, that's not the right thing to do unless it's something of great consequence, then I will. I'm like, if I read something and I go, ooh, this is something I need to know whether it's true or not.
Yeah. I also think that you both hold a position in a lot of people's lives where they're asking you to teach them how to engage with things and how to think about things.
Right.
And so I think that is a responsibility that you have willingly stepped into, and therefore there is some responsibility that comes with that. You could abandon that at any time. I know it's tied to your profession and there's like a whole nother thing that could go to that. But the point is, I think there is a responsibility that you have to people to help them think well, to navigate it, because they have put you in that position to help them do that.
And a responsibility to myself and God to take breaks from that and give myself room for my soul to breathe.
Yes. Amen.
Yeah. So with that being said, I mean, we just talked around a giant issue. We learned some things about the algorithm. We learned, but at the end of that, at the end of the day, if we're going to engage, then we need to do so with some discernment.
Right.
We just can't believe everything we read. We live in a world that's ultimately broken.
Yeah. And then there are some really basic tools that we have been given, like some let's just call them like life skills that we've been told are good to do, like believing the best about another person. You know, going, if you have an accusation against someone, going with a witness, you know, like, I mean, there's like so many things like in terms of relationship and what is your goal? What is your end goal? If you're spreading something, is it to bring about peace? Is it to bring about restoration? Is it to bring about healing? You know, we're in a pandemic. Is it to bring about healing and well-being for people? Is it about, if it's about a person, is it about responsibility? Is it about accountability? Yeah. Then like take all those measures. And as a believer, you're to take them in a loving way. You're to take a disposition of grace. You're supposed to walk as a person who's been forgiven. It doesn't mean that you absolve people of their wrongdoings. It doesn't mean that you're not a person who fights for justice. I mean, we are all of those things, but we've been given those tools. I mean, I think that's pretty much what you're preaching on all month, is like, you know, we've been given these ways of being. Your original question was, how do we engage?
Yeah.
Well, we go back to what God has already said.
Yeah.
These are generally great principles and ways of living with other people in this world where you will have trouble.
Right. Just think how social media would change if we engage it with grace and peace and kindness and self-control.
And under the banner of grace, I have the right to change my mind about something.
That's right. You
should. We all do.
Yeah.
That's a beauty.
Mm-hmm. Anyway, so we're not telling you to abandon social media.
No.
We're just inviting you into it in such a way that you engage it with a discerning, open heart of, maybe some of this stuff isn't exactly as it's presented.
And we all need to evaluate our relationship with it.
Yes, including me, who has a very distant relationship.
Didn't mean to call you out about it.
No. It was legit. And Well, anyway, we're going to bring this to a close. That was a good way to end it. Susie's going to lead us down a path of with an interview with somebody at this point. we hand it over to her now.
Hey everyone, thanks for listening to the Journey Now podcast. If you're enjoying our podcast, would you screenshot and share it with your friends? And please remember to leave us a review, as it does help other people find the podcast. My interview today is with Matt and Sarah Hammett. The Hammetts have been married for 20 years and they have 4 amazing kids. When Sarah was pregnant with their son Bowen in 2010, Bowen was diagnosed with something called hypoplastic left heart syndrome. It's a life-threatening condition that causes the heart to be severely underdeveloped. Well, today, Matt and Sarah share with us how God's taken them through some of the darkest years of their lives and strengthened their faith, as well as their capacity to love and trust Him. They also share how Bowen's story has shaped their whole family. But I want to prepare you that as we dive in fast and right away. Matt and Sarah share with us some details of their son's life, and it might feel traumatic and hard, but if you can hang tight, it really does help frame the depth of what they're sharing with us. You can find out more about the Hammetts and the work that they've done through songwriting, a book, and an upcoming documentary, as well as the foundation they started to help other heart families. All of this can be found at bowensheart.com. Thanks again for being with us. May grace and peace be around you all today. Sarah and Matt Hammett, welcome to the Journey Now podcast. I'm so glad that we were able to do this. You guys are here. We're sitting down. We have so much good stuff to talk about.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks.
Yeah. Well, I want to talk about a lot of things. We're going to try to keep it focused. Primarily, I would love for our listeners to just get to know a little bit about your family. You have been in the throes of life with Bowen and documenting that as a blessing and help for the world and people going through that. But would you share a little bit about your family and what's brought you guys here today?
Yeah. Well, our son Bowen, he was the third of our 4 kids. He, while he was in my tummy, we were diagnosed with something called hypoplastic left heart syndrome, which means he only has half his heart. So we kind of were thrust in this world of CHD 10 years ago. Matt, you want to tell our story? You're better at it.
All right. I was going to let you go for it.
No, you go for it.
So CHD is congenital heart defects. Mm-hmm. So, you know, for people who aren't in that world, it doesn't mean much to hear that. But for people who are in it, it's like one big, as you know.
Yeah.
Once you experience illness, you become part of a community.
Mm-hmm.
And so we were introduced to that world in April of 2010 when Bowen was diagnosed, and really had several months before he was born to kind of sit with the fact that we may or may not keep our baby boy.
Yeah.
And by keep him, I don't mean us not intentionally keep him, but that we would possibly lose him to this disease once he was born. So in the first 6 months of his life, we went through 2 major open heart surgeries and definitely experienced some trauma that we were not expecting, including an evening when Bowen had a cardiac arrest while we were sleeping and kind of ran into a really, what seemed to us be a pretty violent situation, you know, and by violent, I guess, I mean like just we didn't realize that saving a life could look so, right? Like just this team of people coming around our son and just the things that they were having to do, the compressions and his chest is open. And it was like, I don't need to give all the details.
He was 5 days old too.
He was only 5 days old. And it's like, it was like, whoa, like this was such a, it was like something out of a movie for us.
This happened at home, like this, at 5 days old, he was at home?
This happened in the hospital.
Okay. Yeah, so he was born.
We were sleeping around McDonald House.
Yeah.
It was the day of his first surgery. They told us to go get some rest, even though we didn't really want to leave. Mm-hmm. And we were woken up by a phone call, 2:13 a.m. We never forgot the time. And they just told us they'd started compressions. And we ran, and it literally was like we got in the room. He was bluish gray. His chest was open. I mean, one of the nurses had her fingers in his chest, pumping his heart with her fingers. And
gosh.
It was just something that felt like, as it felt like a movie. And once you're through it, it's like, and thank God he survived.
Yeah.
You know, we didn't think, they actually pulled us away from the room after about 45 minutes and we thought he had passed. And then they came back in and told us that he was on life support and that he had survived.
Right, which is called ECMO.
Yeah.
And so the machines are doing all the work and keeping him alive.
Yeah.
And we pretty much thought he was gone for sure. Even when he was on the machines, I mean, it was unlikely he was going to live.
It's hard on his body. So we just, you know, we just pressed through as parents, right? Mm-hmm. So we just were like, so you're kind of overwhelmed by the joy of the fact, like, okay, we made it through the first week of life and now he's made it through the surgery and we have another surgery coming up. You know, it was like at 6 months old, he would have another one. And so we just kind of powered through all that stuff. The second one was much easier. Thank God there were no cardiac arrests. But it was like that initial trauma, I don't think we were aware of it at that time because we were just doing what we needed to do to survive.
Mm-hmm.
But in the coming years, you know, in the early years of Bowen's life, the after effects, the wave of trauma that kind of follows the earthquake, the tsunami, you know, we couldn't really outrun it forever.
Mm-hmm.
So we definitely spent those first few years trying to figure out how to deal with that.
So how many surgeries has he had?
Yeah. So Bowen has had 3 major open heart and 1 regular surgery. So, and a couple heart catheterizations.
Mm-hmm.
So a kid with hypoplastic left heart, basically when 10 years ago when he was diagnosed, when I would research, the only study I could really find that would give me a firm number or firm kind of speculation on outcome was that half of the kids would live till they're 5. So for me, it was just like every day I thought about his death, really probably 150 times a day in the beginning.
Yeah.
You know, how will I react? How will I carry on? And that helped me cope.
Mm-hmm.
So
having all those thoughts and feelings was helping you cope?
Yeah, I thought.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
And I coped by not thinking about it.
But I think that's really helpful for people who are going through something really heavy. I have a friend whose son currently, she's just coming out of this brain cancer thing with him. And she feels crazy for feeling that way all the time. And so I think that's just acknowledging that that's a normal thing for some people. And it's a way to cope for some people. It may not be the long-term way of coping, but
for me, it helped me feel prepared.
Yeah.
Like I had to talk to myself about the worst case scenario. And to me, that made me feel safer because I wouldn't have been sideswiped.
Yeah.
And I was prepared for the worst.
Sure.
Yeah. So, yeah, that's the answer to how many surgeries has he had. Sorry,
we're
popcorning a little bit.
I will say, a little rabbit trail. Sorry.
We are definitely rabbit trailing.
But on what Sarah just said, it is very interesting because when Sarah was through the pregnancy, and after he was born, always thinking about, I'm going to be prepared to leave them. I'm going to be prepared.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas I was thinking, like, I have to leave this family. I've, like, got to be strong.
Mm-hmm.
I can't be constantly thinking about the worst case scenario. And so I would always put it out of my head to keep moving forward. And it was interesting because the night we thought that Bowen passed away when he had his cardiac arrest, in that moment, I was wrecked.
He couldn't even stand on his 2 legs.
Because I hadn't prepared myself for that.
Yeah.
Whereas Sarah was like, I mean, seemed to me Sarah was like stone cold.
Well, I actually didn't cry a single tear because I had cried every day to that moment.
Yeah.
Because I knew I had to be in that moment, that was the moment I had cried about. And in that moment, I was flat because I was like, it's here. And then I started planning his funeral as I was holding his toes. And they were, you know, blood's flying everywhere. And I'm just waiting for them to call the time. But I was very stoic in that moment. So we reversed roles in that moment.
Yeah, it was. I was like, man, I was thinking, how could she be so stoic? But that now, you know, looking back at how she processed and how I processed, you can see.
So going, you know, I'm hearing a lot of like yin yang, like stuff happening. So let's talk a little bit about your family. Let's start with your marriage. What's that been like? Because, I mean, people can go on to, we're going to talk about this more throughout the podcast, but like people can go to bonesheart.com to read about the story. And I would encourage you, dear listeners, to do that because it is an amazing God story. And Bowen is so precious.
He really is.
And so that's really good. But for the trauma, how did it affect what's it been like in your marriage?
I would say, like, you know, I think I'm actually in the process of starting a whole nother website for congenital heart families because I feel like there's so many facets of this disease that we're unaware of till we walk through it. Mm-hmm. One was, as a parent, when you're watching your child going through trauma, you don't really accept that trauma for yourself because it almost feels selfish. Mm-hmm. And so you only identify the trauma as for the child.
Right.
And so you give everything and protect them and try to manage their trauma. Mm-hmm. And it almost feels selfish to say that you've had your own. Mm-hmm. And so you ignore it and you push past it. And I think for me, at about 5 years out, and I think when you're in the middle of the crisis, which I would say we were in the middle of the crisis for 3 years because everything was touch and go. And then he sort of settled out for a while. And so I would say 3 to 5 years, we felt like we were in the crisis. And then when we felt like we were out of the crisis a little bit, the imminent crisis, is when I think some of that trauma really took hold. Mm-hmm. And for me, it was like things like I stopped being able to drive. I was having panic attacks when I was just driving to Target. I felt trapped and I couldn't get out. And what if there's, you know, I felt like there would be an emergency and I couldn't fix it.
And so when did you have your fourth? When did you have Louie?
So Louie was 2 years after Bowen.
Okay.
And yeah.
So now she's the mom of a baby too.
In the midst of all that, you had another baby.
Yeah. We also had a tour bus fire, but that's a story for another day.
Yeah.
Yes. Where I had to pull my two older or healthy ones out of the bus in the middle of the night. But anyway, story for another day. But all of that happened within a really short amount of time. And it was just assaulting on my mind, really.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So
I think the, you know, Sarah and I we got married at 21. Oh, wait, no. Yeah, we got married at 21.
Yeah.
Yeah. Think about that again. We just celebrated 20 years of marriage, so.
Yeah.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Thank you.
July 14th.
We made it.
It's amazing.
I know. It is, right?
It really is.
We were just talking about that before we hit record. It's amazing.
Yeah.
Hardest journey we've ever made.
Yeah. And we, you know, the first 4 years of our marriage, because, you know, you'd ask kind of about our marriage, and I was like thinking about it. I was like, you know, first 4 years of our marriage, we adventured together in this van and trailer with my band, Sanctus Real. And it was like, you know, it was like we had the same adventure, and then she got pregnant with Emmy, and it was, she went home and I stayed on the road, and then we had this career and family dream at odds with each other, you know. And I would say, like, there's still so much beautiful about our marriage, but man, just that, even just me being on the road, you know, kind of like led to a lot of those episodic cycles of conflict that we just were trying so hard to figure out how to deal with. One of the things that's always been hard for us to deal with is figuring out our conflict cycle and how to resolve conflict, you know, well. And I think the trauma really forced us finally to deal with that, because the way that I dealt with the trauma of going through this was that I needed to process because I'm an artist. So I had to step away. Like, I remember being at the hospital. It's like I had to step away for a couple of hours to blog, to write. Whereas Sarah was like, her way of dealing with it was like, I'm going to be at his bedside watching every monitor, monitoring every medication, fighting 24 hours a day. Mm-hmm. So I'm like, how can you never step away from the bedside? And I want a wife a little bit too to walk this with me. And mm-hmm. she was like, and how could you step away from the bedside to go process? You know, mm-hmm. it's like, and so that was like,
that was huge.
And so not, yeah. and so you begin to resent the way that the other person grieves. Mm-hmm. And it is just, it's just such a,
it's heart, tricky.
Mind, so you saw those things as each other as opposed to the way you process, right? Because,
yeah.
you know, like you look at your, you stepping away and you throwing yourself. I mean, you are such an advocate, Sarah, and you yep. throw yourself into the research and the knowing and the paying attention to the details. And like you see those characteristics in each other and see that as the character, right? But
yeah.
it's yeah. not that.
There's beauty in it, but mm-hmm. then you also resent it. It's like, yeah. it's such a weird, I guess, what's the word I'm looking for? It's ambivalent, or mm-hmm. an ambivalence to it, which is like two feelings simultaneously.
Yeah. Well, today, yeah. though, the way you've talked about it today was much more complimentary. So, how yeah. did you get to the place where you can.
Isn't that crazy?
Yeah. I mean, I.
Thank God we got
good
there.
Job, guys. Oh my gosh. But, like, how do you get to that place?
Bowen's where... 10. We're finally there.
yeah.
Well, most of the time, I wouldn't say we're there, but I mean, I think we've done therapy. Some like, and we've tried to learn. I would say therapy really has helped us look at, okay, that's Matt's gift to us, to be able to withdraw and communicate, you know, with people, and you know, that's your gift. So that's
yeah.
great.
Yeah. Well, I was gonna say, you asked how we kind of got to that place where we could actually look at it in that spirit of mm-hmm. not being angry, but seeing it for what it is. And I do think last year, almost a year and a half ago now, we had another like just spike in conflict where we were like, it was just, we were not understanding each other. We just couldn't get through. Mm-hmm. And that's when we decided, hey, let's do an intensive, let's go find, it was during COVID. So it was like we couldn't go anywhere.
Yeah, we did have the assault of COVID right after his last surgery.
So, you know, we actually went through Red Therapy's two-day virtual intensive. And I will say, just in the matter of 2 days, we were starting to learn how to do this, but I feel like we really were able to take some of the deep-rooted stuff. It's almost like our therapist was able to kind of pull it out of us and almost like hold it out so we could look at it and see it objectively for the first time. And I think finally with somebody's help, we were able to go, oh, that's why you acted that way. Mm-hmm. Oh, and that's why you acted that way. And that's actually really beautiful about you, but it just makes me mad, you know? Mm-hmm. And I can now see the beauty and you can understand why it's hard for me and vice versa. I think that, man, that went so far in helping us. But like Sarah said, I mean, that's 10 years later after we've started this journey with Bowen. And you know, his last surgery was in 2019, which we hope is the final surgery. And so we'll see. It's not, the disease isn't curable, mm-hmm. but right now we're in a place where he's doing pretty well.
Yeah.
You know, and so we're able to be a little bit more at ease, I think.
Yeah. So. I'm always amazed at how at ease you seem.
I try to be pretty at ease. I'm naturally kind of an at ease person about most things, not everything. But like even today, even right in this moment, I'm a little concerned about him because he hasn't gained a pound in 2 years since he's been discharged. Mm-hmm. And he's been a little like, I don't know, his color looks a little off, and then his stomach hurts. So these are all heart failure symptoms. Yeah. So like we basically constantly have to evaluate him for heart failure because the next step would likely be a pacemaker or transplant. I mean, really, they think he'll need a transplant, but he's really on the best side of any kids I've seen.
Yeah.
He's one of the top that like functioning children. A lot of them have brain injuries. because they lack oxygen, or they have they have events like Bowen had, and you know, Bowen seems to not have any residual from his hour-long cardiac arrest, which is just a miracle.
Yeah,
but so I mean, I'm sure it tweaks with. Sometimes it's hard because I feel like I'm in a cloud of disease. And I think when you have a kid or maybe someone sick in your life, there's like this constant dialogue running. So you can almost like drop the ball over here, like on with some of the regular life stuff. And so it's hard sometimes in that. Like you don't feel normal, kind of. And sometimes you feel different because you have that constant narrative happening in your mind or whatever, and concern that you always have to be thinking about.
Yeah.
Do people feel normal?
Yeah, exactly.
Does anybody feel normal?
Who feels normal?
Everybody has something though, right?
No, I totally get it.
That's our thing.
So
one of them.
You guys made a documentary.
Yeah.
I want to talk about that in a few minutes. Yeah. But I watched it. It was amazing. And while we're on the topic of your marriage and family, I want to talk about your other kids. Because when I watched the film, and just getting to be, you know, I'm a friend of your family, so I'm around your kids. But I was so, like, it took my respect for your children to a whole nother level.
Yeah.
Watching them and seeing it captured, like, what was... what they stepped up into and how they've processed it and what who they've become. And so you said earlier, like when a child is going through trauma, you feel guilty saying that you've been through trauma.
Yeah.
But surely, like, you understand now, like your kids have too.
Totally.
And so can you talk about that, about what that's been like and how you've navigated that? And then also, like, I'm sure you don't want to, like, you're not like known as, oh, they're the family with the kid with the heart, right? Like, there's so many things that your family is known for, like your the identity of your family, the calling of your family, if you will. Like this is part of it. It's a huge part of it, especially right now. It's a huge part of it. But would you talk about a little bit about your kids and your family culture?
I would say we've tried to be very aware of Bowen not being the golden child. Mm-hmm. So we discipline him. We tell him when he's wrong. No, it isn't. No, it's never been hard for me. I don't know why. I mean, I think it is for some people. He's a really good kid. Like, he really doesn't like to make any mistakes. And so he doesn't really get punished that much. He's the only way he ever really gets punished is when he is getting on to his other siblings.
Yeah.
And so he's never had to be I was going to say spanked. Edit that, because that's controversial.
I spanked all my children.
Okay. But I mean, he just, like, honestly, our kids have barely been spanked, but he's just a great kid. And so, like, I've been very mindful. Like, even going into the documentary, we asked the kids if we could do it. Now, did they know what they were getting into? No, they're kids. Like,
yeah.
But we did ask, and we told them when they were uncomfortable that we would stop, and whatever they needed, we would do. Again, they're children. They don't really know what they're signing up for. We do as adults. And so we were, like, really sensitive about that. But we felt like it's, you know, like a missionary takes their children to Africa.
Yeah.
This is our mission, you know, and this is a, we're being missionaries in the film world, you know? So,
well, and more than just the film world. I mean, you guys definitely have that vibe
in the heart,
where you're for other people is what I get from.
We desperately have wanted our whole lives to take whatever it is that we're struggling with and use it as a tool to help other people. You know, I think that's always been something that's been super important to Sarah and I both. Whether it's, you know, through music or through our book or through the movie. Or just being with people, right? It's like, I think that's the only thing for us that, I mean, it's really the only thing that keeps us going is that purpose, right?
Redemption. Yeah. We're obsessed with redemption. Everything's being redeemed, and how can we be part of that process with our unique gift? But with the kids, with each individual kid, I think, gosh, a lot of times when moms reach out to me and say, like, I'm pregnant, I feel so bad for the other kids. I understand why they say that, but I quickly say to them, it's not going to be easy for anybody. It's going to be hard. But if you look at it biblically, God talks about trials and perseverance, right?
Mm-hmm.
Producing character.
Mm-hmm.
So I always try to say, look at it in a different way. Like, God, this is a trial that was laid on our laps. It's going to produce character. I see character in our kids. I mean, they don't know disability. And so we just went and visited some friends. Heart kid, 12 years old. He had a brain injury.
Mm.
But our children literally, like, it was like he was no different than them.
Yeah, it's like
they
normal
swam,
to them.
They mm-hmm. laughed, they included him. And I look at that. This is the character that was produced by this trial, one of them. And I think that there's a bunch of them. So I feel like, but at the same time, I'm aware that, you know, when they get older, they might have to come back and say, ouch, this hurt and this hurt. And we need to walk through
all
that.
All of our kids are going to do that.
They are.
Yeah.
So I'm aware that, like, there's definitely things that they're going to, that have hurt them too, you know? So.
Yeah.
But I think Sarah, you know, I don't say this in a negative way, but, you know, my family growing up, we just didn't, like, take conflict head on. It was like there were things we probably could have said, maybe we didn't say.
Mm-hmm.
And whereas Sarah is just not, at first it really was hard for me, was how Sarah's like, if there's conflict, we just take it head on, we're going to talk about it. You know, to me it was like super intimidating. And but I see that her willingness to like just give the kids a platform all along the way to like say the hard things that need to be said and talk about them.
That's great.
Yeah.
So they have the freedom to just speak up and say what's hurting them.
And you see it.
They're troubled by.
Yeah. I see that. I see that's a really strength that Sarah's brought to the family. And, you know, we were mentioning the documentary. There is a piece in the documentary that a few people have mentioned to me where Claire just says, you know, Mom, like, you've been kind of rough on us and too easy on Bowen. Like,
mm-hmm. Which she basically didn't realize just says that.
It. Yeah, she's in Sarah's like, okay, I understand. It's fine. But the way
it's
Claire
so
says it's
so good.
Funny. Yeah.
It's so good. And Claire is so much more, you know, she seems the more quiet one
she
to
is.
Me.
Yeah.
And yet in those eyes, you can just see the depth in her soul when she. And, you know, just it's so beautiful to watch.
I think the documentary, I feel like. So I felt the Holy Spirit sort of January before his surgery. He had a surgery in July. I felt the Holy Spirit say, do this. Okay. And then when we went to do it, I was like, there's only one filmmaker I could use. And mm-hmm. it's this woman who had been doing shorts for NBC. She lost a child 5 years ago mm-hmm. to heart disease. And mm-hmm. I was like, that's the only person I can use. So we asked her. She said yes, her and her husband. And then they walked through. But yeah, it was like I had to redeem. Like it was a way to redeem the story, make use out of the pain.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. It was really amazing that it was God's time, because they've been doing all these short docs for NBC. And they're young and they've been wanting to like do their first feature.
Mm-hmm.
So when Sarah called them, it was like they were like saw their opportunity.
That's cool.
To do their first feature. And just at the time that we felt God wanted us to do it.
So. But I really want it to be authentic. So
when
Claire comes in and says those things, I want the hard stuff to be shown, because it wasn't easy and it is messy and mm-hmm. it's gritty. You know, I think we got accepted into the Nashville Film Festival with our film, which we were super excited about. And when we had our interview afterwards, he said, you know, I felt a lot like I feel after a horror movie. And I was like,
we're like, thanks.
Oh. But I mean, I kind of was like, yeah, okay, that makes sense. You really felt my pain.
Yeah.
And the fact that it's not over. And that's exactly, I just wanted people to be able to see how hard it can be to walk certain walks, you know, and maybe to have grace on each other. Everybody's walking a hard walk.
Well, it was cool too, because you know, one of the hospitals we're working with up in Ann Arbor to do an event with the film, the head of their congenital heart center, you know, told us that they felt it would be a piece that would allow their donors to get real insight into what families go through. And so they felt they hadn't had that before at that depth. And so that was really encouraging to know, like, you know, even this massive heart center is like, hey, this is a valuable thing for us to share the depth of what people are feeling and hurting, how they're hurting in our hospitals. And to have that as a tool just made us feel like, okay, you know what? That's, I don't know. It just does. It brings so much purpose to what we've experienced.
Yeah.
And you've really done a great job of coming alongside other heart families. I mean, you mentioned the other website that you're starting, but you, I mean, it seems to me that you really live and breathe wanting to come alongside other families that are going through what you're going through.
Yeah, it's interesting. I've never really been like, when I was young, I didn't really have anything like a dream. Like I wanted to get married and have kids, but I didn't want to be a teacher or a, you know, doctor. I didn't have any of these dreams, but I'm a super driven person and passionate. Mm-hmm. So when this all happened, it was like my dream came to me, I guess, or my passion, I should say, in helping other people. So now I have this purpose and this, obviously it's not a dream come true, but like in this now, the redemption of it and the purpose I'm finding in it, I feel like it's just what we're supposed to do. Yeah, and we have a foundation actually too, where we do all sorts of little things for people. Like we bought a dog for a dying person, for like there was a woman, she was 34 and I knew she was dying, and I was like, what do you want that just would make you happy? And she wanted a dog, and so she got to have her dog for a couple months before she passed. And we paid for funerals, and gosh, we've actually done quite a bit with that little foundation, haven't we?
Yeah, it's not that often big, but yeah, we just take what we get and
lighten the load for other people,
pay mortgages, and because people are in, I remember we started our foundation when we were in the hospital, and we were like, well, we don't really need anything. But I mean, she's, you know, the person next to me is losing their house, and the person over here is, you know, so we thought, well, we should start a foundation so we can help people, you know? So,
I think it's really profound, Sarah, that you have found a calling and a purpose through your suffering. You know, I don't think a lot of us walk through suffering with that openness and that. And I don't know that you did that on purpose either.
It's just coping.
But it's just like, but, you know, just to make ourselves available to a road that God wants us to travel, not just for ourselves, but for other people, I think is really profound.
Well, thank you.
Nobody really wants God to declare your purpose through your suffering.
No, that's not something we ask for.
It is very profound. You're right. How he does that.
Yeah.
So what's the foundation called?
Whole Hearts Foundation.
Okay.
Yep.
And so how do, can people watch the film, the documentary, or do we have to wait?
Well, for right now, we're kind of in the middle of, you know, we, fortunately, what, a year ago in September, Good Morning America came to our house, and they did a great piece, which you can find at bowensheart.com, on the documentary. And we had the admittance to the Nashville Film Festival, but now we're in the process of finding somebody to distribute it.
Okay.
So that's apparently a long process. Yeah. So our agent this week, I think, has a second meeting with Hulu. So that's kind of exciting.
Yeah.
We'll see.
Yeah.
We don't know where God has it going, but, and then also we're going to use it as fundraisers for, heart units across the country. There's like specific congenital heart units that take a lot of money to run.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a lot of fundraisers, and we're going to take the film and raise funds in those.
That's great.
In those units. So,
so the film is going to be used to go wide and broaden the scope of things, to get resources to people, to get help to people. But in the immediate future, people can go to bowensheart.com to read your story, to read your blog, to connect with you on Instagram.
And then, and all that good stuff. And we'll let people know when it's available for streaming. So
that's great.
And, you know, I came out with a book called Leave Me last year with Waterbrook Multnomah, and we do write about Bone's story a little more in depth than that too.
There's really good detail there.
If people want to check that out, they can find it wherever they get books.
That's great.
So
we'll put all that in the show notes. Thanks so much, you guys.
Thanks
I love
for
your
us.
Family.
Yeah,
I'm
thanks.
So glad you're here and part
thank
of us.
You. I appreciate that. We love you. So thanks for having us.
If you enjoyed today's episode, we would love it if you would share a screenshot of this episode to your Instagram story and tag us at journey_TN. And don't forget to subscribe and leave us a review on your favorite podcasting app.